Of all the tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. It may be better to live under robber barons than under omnipotent moral busybodies. C.S. Lewis.
This is how liberty dies. With thunderous applause.
Welcome to Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. I'm Scott, and as always, I'm lucky to be joined by Uncle Ian. This week, we're in Central America. One of these two dictators will be eliminated from the tournament. The winner remains in the contest to be crowned history's biggest dictator. Hugo Rafael Chavez and
Manuel Antonio Noriega Moreno.
Uncle Ian, your Spanish pronunciation is fantastic. So, let's get started. Uncle Ian, please tell us about the dictator of Panama, Noriega.
Thanks, Scott. Manuel Noriega, born on the 11th of February 1934, although he sometimes claimed 1936 or 1938, depending on the circumstances, he was born in Panama City to a poor Pardo family. Pardo means tri-racial descent. So he had ancestors who'd come from Southern Europe, ancestors who were indigenous Americans, and ancestors who'd come from West Africa. His mother was a cook and a laundress. His father was an accountant. Both had died by the time he turned 5. He was raised by a godmother. So let's look at the country of Panama. It's at the bottom of Central America. Or, depending on your perspective, it's at the top of South America. The country was discovered for Europe in 1502 by Columbus, colonised by Spain. In 1821, Panama broke away from Spanish rule, became part of Gran Colombia, which was territory stretching across to Venezuela and down to Peru. One of the early elements of the South American independence movement. In 1903, Panama seceded with help from the USA because the USA wanted to build a canal, the shortest route between the Caribbean and the Pacific Oceans was going to be across Panama.
Help from the Americans is a light way to put it, do you think, Uncle Ian?
The US was prepared to get more forceful with the Colombian government if necessary, in order that they were only negotiating with a smaller country in Panama to get access to the land.
They effectively invented the country. The reason for the canal is interesting because it's not just to get shipping across for trade, but also the American Navy's being stuck on either side of the oceans. They weren't particularly happy about that. So if you think about the Second World War and they're fighting the Germans and the Japanese, they've got to get their ships from one ocean to the other. So having a canal is very helpful.
Yeah, and you're right, Scott. There's a strategic component to it, as well as enabling cruise ships and container ships to go through. The Panama Canal is 65 kilometres in length, which compared to sailing all the way around the bottom of South America makes a pretty massive difference. So Noriega attended the National Institute High School, I won't try and say that in Spanish, met his older half-brother, Luis Carlos, who introduced him to the youth wing of the Socialist Party. In the 1950s, they were protesting against the US presence in the Canal Zone. Noriega became an informer for US intelligence in the mid-1950s. His first payment for information on the Socialist Party that he provided to the US authorities was the grand sum of $10.70. Even if you allow for inflation and an exchange rate, it doesn't sound like very much.
No.
It grew. He actually wanted to be a doctor, but he was unable to gain entry into medical school. So in 1958, off to the military school in Lima in Peru, graduated in 1962, specialising in engineering. He became a second lieutenant in the Panama National Guard. His commanding officer was Major Omar Torrijos. We'll hear more about him.
Despicable Behavior was on show from a very young age. In 1966, he was found to have raped a 13-year-old girl.
The National Guard was used to harass, arrest and torture political rivals of the governing Liberal Party. In 1967, President Johnson identified that Noriega was a rising star and someone that the US should cultivate as an anti-communist. That's as much based on what they knew about Torrijos and Noriega as based on the importance of the Canal Zone territory and Panama's strategic location. At this stage, the canal on either side was US territory. So there was a canal zone running right through the middle of Panama, and that was still US ground.
And they weren't particularly happy about this, the Panamanians.
You're right. You know, they'd been colonised by Spain. They still thought they were being colonised by the United States with this strip of land running right through the middle of the country.
And because if you lived in the South and you wanted to go visit your family in the North, you had to go through America and get passport checks and get your rubber stamp.
Yeah, exactly. So in 1968, President Arias was elected. He lasted 11 days before Torrijos led a coup with Noriega as one of his supporting officers. By 1970, Noriega had rapidly risen to being a lieutenant colonel. He was now chief of military intelligence. Torrijos remained president until 1981, having negotiated the return of the Canal Zone from the US to Panamanian jurisdiction that ultimately occurred in 1999. During his time as chief of military intelligence, Noriega sent 1,300 Panamanians into exile, and he kept extensive files for use in future blackmail. Nothing like planning ahead. And by 1971, he was officially on the CIA payroll, providing information about Cuba and Nicaragua. Back to the CIA. During 1976, the Canal Zone became quite a hotspot. There were bombings, which were directed against the occupying American forces. At one stage, the director of the CIA, named George Bush, met with Noriega to discuss the bombings. Noriega promised to investigate, but nothing ever happened.
This is George Bush Sr.
George Bush Sr. We'll hear more of him later. 13th of July 1981, Torrijos died in a plane crash. The next word, Scott, I've got written here is, in inverted commas, mysterious. So,
in these sort of situations, you have to think, who benefits from this situation? Exactly. Because Torrijos and the Americans had agreed to hold elections. That was part of the negotiations for returning the Canal Zone back to Panama. And so he says, oh, you know what, I'll have elections. I'll sail off into the sunset. And then I guess someone had other ideas. And then a plane crashed.
Yeah. It's still a political tactic. Only a week or two before recording this episode, there's been a mysterious plane crash in northern Russia.
Yes, there has.
Yet to be investigated. Noriega became part of a triumvirate ruling Panama. The triumvirate came up with a plan as to who was going to be the president. In 1983, Noriega backtracked on that deal because he wanted his own candidate in place. Noriega himself didn't claim the title of president, but by then he was a general of the Panama Defense Force, been expanded and modernized with US assistance. His title at that stage, Scott, was Maximum Leader.
I haven't heard that one before. That's fantastic.
Now, I have to accept it may lose something in the translation. However, my belief is that this was an attempt to claim the one title as yet unclaimed by Idi Amin.
His nickname? Uncle Ed, you haven't told us his nickname. What was it?
I'm sorry. Sorry, Scott. His nickname was Pineapple Face. And again, I'm not sure that loses anything in the translation, but it became an offence to say that in Panama.
This was because he had acne scarring, so that people would call him Pineapple Face. But yeah, he's very sensitive about it.
So the PRD, known as the Democratic Revolutionary Party, was the political front for the Panama Defence Force. Noriega gained control of everything, the media, all the transport networks, customs and immigration, all of which meant that he had oversight of all the infrastructure to support the drug trafficking and weapons trading activities. The promised presidential election was run in 1984. The front runner was the same Arias who'd been ousted by the coup in 1968. When it became obvious that Arias was going to be victorious, Noriega called it void and installed his own candidate as president. The US supported this because Noriega permitted US bases in Panama, regional listening posts, the CIA called them, to monitor Nicaragua and El Salvador. The US Army and CIA, in the 3 decades between the mid-50s and the mid-80s, in terms of the amount of money paid to Noriega to be an informant, an agent, the lowest estimate is $320,000. The highest estimate is $11 million.
Yeah, okay.
That was paid personally to Noriega. Probably the biggest scandal from the US perspective was the Contra scandal, which involved the selling of US arms to Iran. At that stage, Iran was embargoed from purchasing weapons, and this was subsequent to the takeover by the Ayatollahs in 1979. However, the US, behind its own back, wanted to come to an arrangement with Iran to trade off a whole range of other issues. There were hostages in Lebanon who could be freed if Iran got the weapons it wanted. If we sell arms clandestinely, we'll make a profit. We can then supply more weapons to the Contra rebels in Nicaragua who oppose the left-wing Sandinistas. We also want to supply arms to Israel so that we're keeping the power balance in the Middle East.
So you're going to sell arms to Iran to make money so that you could give arms to Israel so they can combat Iran's weapons.
That's right.
Yeah.
On top of all this, remember we've got the listening post down in Panama. Noriega had influence, power, contacts and networks in the region. And if you overlook his own drug trafficking and human rights abuses, Noriega was running a regime that was a staging post for weapons and money to come from the US and then find its way into Nicaragua to support those rebels. All of this is happening with Reagan's knowledge, and in early 1987, Reagan went on television to confess all of this.
But Congress was not keen on this whole idea. That's why he had to do it clandestinely.
That's right. Iran was embargoed. There was no way they could do it up front. At the time, Noriega was working both sides of the street. At the same time as taking all this money from the US and supporting their local strategies in Central America, he was cooperating with the USA's enemies. He was selling passports to Cuban intelligence officials to enable them to travel on a Panamanian passport. He was working with the drug cartels over the border in Colombia. He was also allied with regimes in Libya, the Soviet Union, South Africa, all based on supporting his power and authority and bank balance. In 1985, political opponent Hugo Spadafora was kidnapped and subsequently found murdered. He was tortured and then beheaded, purely for having spoken out against Noriega's regime. This became a watershed moment in Panama society. In 1987, his former ally, Herrera, was charged with treason after leading protests against the paramilitary loyalists who were trying to quell the public riots. These paramilitary loyalists were known by Noriega, and again, this might lose something in the translation, as the Dignity Battalions, just to try and keep the peace on the street. From what I've read about these, they were exactly the same as Hitler's stormtroopers, and beat up anyone who got in their way. By 1988, the US had, I'm going to use the term lost patience, but I think it went further than that. They issued an indictment and said that Noriega was, quote, turning Panama into a shipping platform for South American cocaine destined for the US and allowing drug proceeds to be hidden in Panama's banks, end quote. There was another presidential election due in May 1989, so for the sake of public appearances, Noriega allowed the election to proceed. One of the senior international observers was the same Jimmy Carter who'd negotiated the return of the Canal Zone with Torrijos. After Noriega voided the election, Carter publicly declared that the election had been stolen. There was a subsequent coup by the National Guard. That failed. Noriega arranged for the torture and execution of 9 officers who'd been involved in that coup attempt. The New Yorker magazine by this time was describing Panama as a thugocracy. I don't think we've met that word yet. That's a Scott, good one. The US Senate.
That sounds like 50 Cent's 4th album title.
The US Senate had used their 5th album title, the term narco-kleptocracy.
Ooh, that's Rick Ross's 3rd album, I think.
So, on the 16th of December 1989, a US soldier was killed in Panama City after a confrontation. Remember, the Canal Zone was still US territory at this stage. The transfer wasn't to take place till 1999. So on the 20th of December 1989, authorised by the former head of the CIA, now president, George Bush Sr., the US invaded. 27,000 soldiers, 300 aircraft. I think it's fair to say they meant it.
Yeah.
That's a lot to invade a country of 2 million people when you're really only after one. This followed a public speech that Noriega had given where he was taunting the Americans. There's actually footage of him speaking at a rally, all chosen sycophants in the audience. He's waving a machete over his head and basically daring the United States to come and get him. Do your worst. Come and get me.
That is an unwise decision.
Yeah, they just followed his instructions, basically.
The machete as well against the American army. Don't bring a knife to a gunfight.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. The invasion led to the death of some 500 Panamanian civilians, and 23 US soldiers lost their lives. So, Noriega sought refuge in the Vatican Embassy. The US troops went, okay, we'll smoke him out. We know he likes opera, so we're going to wheel out some very loud non-opera music. This includes music by the bands Judas Priest, Twisted Sister, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers with their hit Refugee, and naturally Bon Jovi's Wanted Dead or Alive. Eventually the Papal Nuncio convinced Noriega that he wasn't going to be able to stay in the Vatican Embassy forever. So on the 3rd of January 1990, Noriega surrendered, was transferred as a prisoner of war to Miami. By then, he was in his mid-50s, depending on which date of birth you believe. The US were very keen to publicise the traditional mugshot with the prisoner number card on his chest as well. He doesn't look as if he's enjoyed Christmas and New Year, let's put it that way. So he's put on trial in the US. The US authorities refused to take into account his time on the US payroll. And they said that was for national security reasons. We can't have that evidence put forward in court. He was convicted, sentenced to 40 years in prison, ended up serving 17 years. In 2010, he was extradited to France. He had used drug money to invest in property in France. So the French authorities wanted him for money laundering. He was convicted, sentenced to 7 years in jail. In December 2011, he was extradited to Panama. He'd previously been tried and convicted in absentia for all of the murders that had been committed on his watch. Convicted, sentenced to 20 years in jail. In March 2012, diagnosed with a brain tumour. May 2017, died at the age of 83. Scott, this particular individual has been convicted and sentenced and served time in three different countries.
Who do you think has the best prisons out of those three?
It's interesting because he was interviewed in 2015 and he did say that in the US and France he'd been treated according to the Geneva Convention. Remember that he was treated as a prisoner of war by the United States. So he actually went on record as saying he had no complaints about his prison treatment in the US and in France. My guess is if any of the prison guards in Panama had relatives who'd been among all those people that were tortured or exiled, then he may not have had good treatment in the Panama jail. For us to have a dictator who's been convicted and sentenced in three different countries, I think that's our record so far. Perhaps his three convictions in three different countries helps make up for all of the dictators we've met so far that never faced court once. Scott, as you know, I always enjoy a good obituary. It's in a magazine called The Atlantic. And it made reference to Pinochet, Fidel Castro, and Noriega, all ending their lives quietly as frail old men. The article went on to make reference to Pinochet as an ally of the United States, to Castro as a nemesis of the United States. Noriega managed to be both. And the BBC made reference to the US Senate subcommittee, which described Washington's relationship with Noriega as one of the USA's most serious foreign policy failures. I think that's pretty damning.
This is the worst one, because he's such a bad guy, and for the entire period he's a bad guy. On one hand, they're paying him to spy on the communists while they know he's running drugs that the other half of the government is trying to stop. And then once the communism threat subsides, and then obviously the drug problem in America in the 80s gets much worse, so they get rid of him.
At that stage, the US had to acknowledge that the rising star that President Johnson had identified 22 years ago when he was still a lieutenant had really played off the Americans quite well.
Yeah.
And of course, remembering 1989, massive year. In November, the Berlin Wall had fallen. The US had, to its credit, established a good relationship with Gorbachev in Moscow. So it was going to be a lot harder for your archetypal Latin American dictator to milk that. To put it another way, Scott, within 5 days of the US invading Panama, Ceausescu was killed. And I remember at the time it was a bit like, where's this going to happen next?
So up against Noriega today, of course, we have Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela. Crackers from Caracas, as he's affectionately known. Venezuela is on the north coast of the South American continent, just next to Colombia. Hugo Chavez was born on the 28th of July, 1954, in a small town of Sabaneta, Venezuela. Mr. Chavez was destined for a career in the military, attending the Venezuelan Academy of Military Sciences, where his soon-to-be-famous charisma and leadership quickly earned him many admirers. Like all left-wing students,
Chavez was inspired by reading the memoir of Argentine Marxist revolutionary Che Guevara. I can imagine Chavez walking around with his Che Guevara t-shirt, having a great time. In 1977, Chavez's unit was transferred to Anzoátegui, where they were involved in battling a Marxist insurgency group. After intervening himself to prevent the beating of an alleged insurgent by other soldiers, Chavez began to have his doubts about the army, so he founded and recruited soldiers into a Marxist cell within the army. In 1989, the president used the Venezuelan army to suppress the widespread lootings and protests going on in Caracas. Members of Chavez's movement embarrassingly participated in the crackdown, but luckily for Chavez, he was hospitalized with the chickenpox at the time.
Very convenient.
Allowing him to subsequently criticize the heavy-handed crackdown. So now the fun begins. In 1992, he led a faction of leftist soldiers hoping to overthrow the government by capturing the president, military bases, and media broadcasters. The whole coup was a massive debacle full of betrayals, defections, and unforced errors. One of which was the Venezuelan military were ordered to suppress the coup, resulting in both sides wearing identical military uniforms, causing everyone to forget who they should be shooting at. Chavez's revolutionary forces were eventually trapped inside a museum, and the president promised to send the Air Force to bomb the museum if he didn't surrender. So he gave a speech declaring his surrender, and Chavez was imprisoned for 2 years. 2 years seems like a light sentence for attempting to overthrow the government, particularly considering at least 32 people were killed. And also considering that in his speech, he said that the coup had failed.
For now.
Sorry.
It doesn't really give the impression of contrition and remorse.
I think that was part of a deal that was done, that Chavez was prepared to surrender.
We've had a few dictators who have come to power after imprisonment for failed takeovers. Off the top of my head, we've had Lenin, Stalin, Saddam, Fidel Castro, Ceausescu, Napoleon, and Mugabe. Upon his release from prison, Chavez founded the Revolutionary Bolivarian Movement, 200. What does the 200 mean? It just sounds good, I think. The MBR 200. He gave fiery speeches condemning the corruption and advocating for a more equitable society, which earned him popularity among the Venezuelan people. He famously said, "Capitalism is the way of the devil and exploitation. If you really want to look at things through the eyes of Jesus Christ, who I think was the first socialist, only socialism can really create a genuine society." He would later say, "I have always said that it would not be strange that there had been a civilization on Mars. But maybe capitalism arrived there, imperialism arrived, and finished off the planet."
Crackers, you're right.
When Elon gets to Mars, we can have a look for maybe there's a shopping mall, an evidence of capitalism that destroyed the planet. He toured around South America, finding powerful leftist friends, including Fidel Castro. Chavez could be folksy and funny and entertaining and vulgar, and this gift helped him build an unbeatable connection with poor Venezuelans and also disparage his opponents. He said of his election opponent, "You have a pig's tail, a pig's ears. You snort like a pig. You're a low-life pig. You're a pig. Don't try and hide it." Uncle Ian, I'm sure both sides of politics will hate me for saying it, but Hugo Chavez is Donald Trump. The humor and the charm, the vulgarity, the machismo, the working class appeal, the populist policies, they're the same.
Yeah, the self-belief.
In 1998, he won the presidential election promising a Bolivarian revolution to redistribute wealth and power in Venezuela, although he promised not to nationalize any industries. Let's see how that goes.
What sort of a lefty is he,
Scott? Yeah. Chavez was a Catholic and saw his socialist policies rooted in the teachings of Jesus Christ, and enjoyed using the slogan, "Christ is with the revolution." Of course, Marx rejected the institutions and supernatural elements of religion, but his writings of equality and revolution derived from Christian teachings. For example, mankind has inherent equal value by being made in God's image, and Jesus states, "The first shall be last, and the last shall be first." Uncle Ian, any more Marxist scripture you can quote for us?
Not directly off the top of my head.
Something about a camel and a needle.
Yeah. One of the things that enabled Chavez to be so popular was that as young army officers, they'd watched the oligarchy misuse the massive revenues pouring into Venezuela because there was oil offshore, and that made Venezuela a very rich economy, but the proceeds weren't shared around. And while Chavez was in jail, the then president was being impeached for corruption and ended up in jail himself. So when Chavez comes out of jail and preaches to the underprivileged, he was able to really strike a chord with the population.
Well, and perhaps like with Trump, there was a low bar for existing politicians. There was a lot to complain about.
Yeah.
Uncle Ian, we've heard a lot about this Bolivar. What is a Bolivar?
Simon Bolivar, in the early part of the 19th century, was determined to lead South American countries in their independence battles from Spain. So he inspired the independence movements in what we now know as Argentina and Chile, in Peru, in Colombia, and in Venezuela. Peru at that stage was comprised of Upper and Lower Peru, Lower Peru on the Pacific Ocean, Upper Peru in the mountains. After all these countries gained their independence from Madrid, Upper Peru was renamed Bolivia, and that's where the name comes from. And he was seen as a real superhero of South American independence from the colonial powers. So it would be a bit like Putin now saying, we're going back to what Lenin gave to us, even if that wasn't his intention at all, but evoking the past of a great revolutionary power.
Or even Washington, George Washington.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, good example. Or Mussolini wanting to be seen to be treading in the footsteps of the Roman emperors.
And even Venezuela's currency is called the Bolivar. And they don't really do his memory justice because it's not really worth anything after all the devaluations, which we'll get to. So Hugo Chavez is president and creates a seismic shift in the life of the people. He portrayed himself as a champion of democracy while undermining democratic institutions. Chavez concentrated power in his own hands, weakened checks and balances, and extended presidential terms through a new constitution in 1999. He made all the decisions. Institutions like the judiciary were completely controlled by Hugo Chavez. This new constitution allowed him to run for re-election indefinitely, despite the fact that when asked in 1998 if he would hand over power in 5 years, he responded, "Of course, I'm willing to give up power even earlier." I don't want to keep mentioning Trump, but that's a full Trump comment. I am the best at handing over power.
Yes.
During Chavez's rule, political opponents faced harassment, imprisonment, or exile. I know which one I would take. Media outlets critical of the government often experienced unexpected shutdowns. And the election of the assembly in 1999 was quite irregular. To elect the members of the assembly, Chavez used a formula designed by mathematical experts. His supporters received 51% of the vote, but won 95% of the seats. An unimaginative dictator would lie and say he won 95% of the vote. Only Chavez uses creative accounting to make the vote meaningless. The 2004 recall referendum, which was an attempt to remove Chavez from office, was also marred by electoral fraud. Now, Uncle Ian, the TV show. Are you ready for the TV show? His main propaganda vehicle was a Sunday TV show called Hello, Mr. President, where he was both the host and the guest. The show was complete mayhem. Sometimes it would go for 7 hours. Sometimes they'd move his desk outside and film it at the beach. One episode was filmed at a hospital to show the improvements in Venezuelan healthcare, and a sick girl walked in with a stomach pain and Chavez poked her in the stomach and claimed to heal her. Some episodes were broadcast on all TV and radio channels, which was a presidential capability, which was theoretically for emergencies and evacuations, but he just took over and days of television was forced on the public. There was an excellent recurring segment where Chavez was filmed expropriating property owned by rich people, in which he would dramatically point at a building and shout, "Expropriate!" which became his catchphrase. Many Venezuelans tuned in because Chavez was known for unveiling financial assistance packages or other social benefits. So I suppose there was like a game show element.
And this week's winner is...
Yeah. And it wasn't just on TV. He would announce his giveaways. In 2012, he gave his 3 millionth Twitter follower a new apartment.
Interestingly, in relationship to things like his television show and the party rallies, the New York Times called him a polarizing leader with a televangelist's gift for oratory.
That's fantastic. He just could speak for hours and hours. He just wear you down.
Yeah.
In terms of his personal life, he married and divorced twice. He developed a reputation for womanizing, which probably contributed to the divorces. I'm not sure what she had to complain about, though. On Valentine's Day in the year 2000, he publicly announced, referencing Marisabel, his second wife, "Marisabel, I'm giving you one tonight. Get ready." Unfortunately, it wasn't all healing the sick and giving one to his wife, Marisabel. Despite Venezuela's vast oil wealth, Chavez's rule became famous for economic mismanagement and a sharp decline in living standards. The government's extravagant spending on social programs and subsidies, fueled by oil revenues, led to economic instability. Chavez nationalized key industries like telecommunications and banking, which deterred foreign investment, enabled corruption, and hindered economic growth. Even oil production, the sole source of Venezuela's wealth, was nationalized, causing a collapse in production. Hyperinflation became a critical issue, causing the Bolivar, Venezuela's currency, to lose its value. Basic goods like food and medicine became scarce, resulting in widespread shortages and long lines at grocery stores. Chavez's controversial seizure of land disrupted the agricultural production, which exacerbated the food shortages and made them dependent on more expensive imports. This was despite the fact that the price of crude oil per barrel when Chavez took over in 1999 was $22 and became $145 by 2011. But somehow they're still losing money. His presidency did have some successes. He implemented numerous social programs known as missions, which improved healthcare access and extreme poverty. And Uncle Ian, you could probably finish my sentence here. Like all great dictators in this show, Chavez embarked on a...
Is that an education reform program?
Literacy program. So the government claimed that this program taught 1.5 million illiterate adults to read and write. However, according to Wesleyan University and the IESA, their study found that only 1.1 million were illiterate to begin with. And quote, "The true illiteracy reduction of less than 100,000 can be attributed to adults who were elderly and died."
It's a more creative accounting, Scott.
Well, I suppose, I mean, he did technically reduce illiteracy by having people die.
So that was the week when he wasn't running his television show at the hospital.
That's right. His program to reduce malaria was plagued by corruption, as the funds were somehow diverted into his friends' bank accounts.
He did have some fun on the international stage, forming alliances with other leftist leaders in Latin America, which prioritized ideology over national interests. It was at a South American summit he famously declared, "I think we are suffering from political impotence. We need political Viagra." His close relationship with Cuba's Fidel Castro resulted in extensive Cuban influence in Venezuela and considerable financial burden on the country. Chavez kept communist Cuba afloat by providing 100,000 subsidized barrels of oil a day. He also supported a violent guerrilla movement in neighboring Colombia. That's guerrilla, G-U-E. And Nguyen, of course, he frequently clashed with US officials on matters of foreign policy. He enjoyed criticizing Americans in public settings, speaking about George W. Bush at the United Nations. He said, "Yesterday the devil came here, right here, and it smells like sulfur still today." And it's not just one side of politics. On Obama in 2011, he said, "You are a fraud, Obama. Go and ask many people in Africa who might have believed in you because of the color of your skin, because your father was from Africa. You are an Afro-descendant, but you are the shame of all those people."
Harsh.
And perhaps he was thinking of ticking the anti-Semitism box for Dictator Bingo in 2006 when he complained that the descendants of the same ones that crucified Christ had now taken possession of all the wealth in the world.
He's certainly got a unique style about him. He was inspired by Bolivar to the extent that one of the organizations that he founded was the Union of South American Nations. Another one was called the Bolivarian Alliance. And he had dreams of a United States of South America, for want of a better term. And this is while he's using oil revenue to sponsor client states in places like Bolivia and also in Nicaragua. He was very keen to be seen not just as the leader of Venezuela, but also as someone who was a strong man right across Latin America.
Similar to Gaddafi wanting to be the ruler of all of Africa.
Yeah, it's a good analogy. Part of that was he was pursuing that because he knew that was something the United States didn't want.
As his presidency continued, the economic situation did get worse. The price of oil between 1998 and 2006, malnutrition deaths fell by 50% due to the price controls he placed on food. So that's exciting. However, price controls later led to shortages since merchants could no longer afford to import necessary goods. By 2011, food prices in Caracas was 9 times higher than when the price controls were put in place. So he attempted to fill these shortages by nationalizing the food industry, which led to more shortages. Which was a shame, but Nguyen starting his own government supermarket did allow him retail space over which he could plaster posters of his face.
Plus he could advertise the supermarket on television.
Although I'm not sure how much it helps having your face plastered above empty shelves of strawberries and rice.
It's not a good image, is it, now that you think about it?
There was one shortage he was happy to have. In 2009, he banned Coke Zero, claiming it was bad for human health. Of all the problems in the country to be addressing, Coke Zero. He also promised to ban Halloween, thinking it was a
Satanic or something like
that? No, it was like an imperialist holiday of the American colonial power, which I actually agree with. Celebrate normal Australian things.
Still had higher priorities, though.
So external bodies have ranked the country's economic freedom at 174th out of 177.
Do we know who was below?
The Somalis were below, and I imagine the North Koreans were below. The other issue they were having was Chavez released all the violent criminals from prison. Some sort of, let's get everyone out of prison, it'll be great, prisons are bad, all that. Then crime was so prevalent that in 2007, the government no longer produced crime data.
but an NGO estimated kidnappings rose 2,000%. Homicide rates nearly quadrupled, and in 2010, there were more violent deaths in Caracas than in Baghdad at the height of the Iraq War. Government agencies advised families of the murder victim not to report the death to the media, and in exchange, they would expedite the process of releasing the victim's body. It's always the cover-up. That's worse than the crime, isn't it? So, in 2011, newspapers begin reporting rumors that Chavez has cancer. In early June, the Venezuelan vice foreign minister stated, "The only thing that has metastasized is the cancer of the right-wing media." And then on the 30th of June, Chavez announces he's being treated for cancer. In October, Chavez announces that he's beaten cancer, saying there are no malignant cells in this body. They don't exist. Then in February 2012, he returns to Cuba for cancer treatment. In July, with the election 3 months away, Chavez declares that he has beaten cancer. In October, he wins re-election, then returns to Cuba for cancer treatment. In 2013, Venezuela's Supreme Court, which he owns, rules that Hugo Chavez will remain president even though he's too unwell to attend his inauguration.
In 2011, in relation to his health, Chavez strongly hinted that because leaders throughout South America, in Argentina and Brazil and Paraguay, in addition to himself, were all suffering from cancer, he strongly implied that the US had had a hand in all of those South American leaders suffering from cancer. He was unable to supply any evidence.
Maybe they all just drank too much Coke Zero.
Clandestine Coke Zero, yes.
And on March 5th, 2013, the vice president announces that Hugo Chavez has died at age 58. Although defectors have since revealed that he actually died in December the previous year, but they decided to delay the announcement of his death for political reasons. He was succeeded by his vice president, Nicolas Maduro, who has held on to power since 2013, with the clever strategy of banning opposition parties from elections.
So that's very impressive. To his credit, he never voided any elections. There were plenty of referenda, parliamentary and presidential elections. But I'd like to share with you, Scott, the results of the presidential elections which he contested. In 1998, he was elected president with 56% of the vote. In 2000, he was re-elected with 56.2%. In 2006, he was elected with 62.8% of the vote. And I think the most impressive performance was in 2012, remembering that he was barely in the country to campaign. He still got 55.1% of the vote. So that presidential majority is a long way short of the benchmark for dictator Binga.
Which is 99.7, I think.
Exactly, yeah. So that does imply that Chavez was genuinely elected into his presidential role.
It did help that certain opposition people would go missing.
True.
All right, Uncle Ann. Well, we have to pick a winner between these two excellent Central South American dictators, Noriega and Chavez. What are you thinking? I think in terms of biggest, baggest, meanest, Noriega sounds like a vicious creature.
Yeah, I look at Chavez and I can see some redeeming features. The education and welfare and health programs. Whereas with Noriega, I can't find any redeeming features.
He doesn't have a moral compass at all. I think that's what's hard to see anything positive in him. Yeah. Whereas Chavez, he has all these policies that just too hard, they don't work, it all falls apart. But even though he does things in the wrong way, I feel like there is a genuine attempt to achieve something for the people.
Yeah. And with Noriega, he reminds me of someone like Mubarak, who was in the military, ended up being in the right place at the right time, With Noriega, I struggle to see anything positive you could say about him. And to be convicted and sentenced and incarcerated in three countries, I don't know that we're going to be able to match that, Scott.
No, I don't think we are. Well, Napoleon got sent to two separate prisons.
It's true. Napoleon was exiled, and they kept having to find islands further and further away that he couldn't come back from.
So I suppose he's our winner. He's got to be.
Yeah, I think Chavez probably will be a bit disappointed in that space, because from a charismatic point of view, he would probably expect to be given the honour.
Chavez will be missed in the tournament. He provided excellent entertainment. But Noriega will remain in the contest to be crowned history's biggest dictator. Uncle Ann, got a few episodes left before we get into the quarterfinals. Who do we have next week? Where are we going?
Next episode, Scott, we're going to Germany.
Okay.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you, Uncle Ed.